Well, in the scorching summer of 1959, Hollywood descended on the sleepy city of Melbourne to make an apocalyptic film. It was called On the Beach. The director and producer was Stanley Kramer, and it starred three Hollywood legends. There was Ava Gardner, Gregory Peck, and Fred Astaire, and a tall, skinny young actor named Anthony Perkins. It was based on the novel of the same name by a hugely popular writer, a British-Australian, who's named Neville Shute. In the story, the rest of the world has been destroyed in a nuclear war. Melbourne is the last place where anyone is alive. But these isolated survivors have only 5 months at most. They know that eventually the nuclear winds will blow south and kill them too. This morning, we look at the historical background to that film.
Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable.
It was a serious possibility for the world.
On the Beach had met with an extraordinary public response when it was released in America.
I think that my dad would be very surprised that it has lasted for 50 years. Maybe a bit disappointed that the world hadn't learned anything.
That's from a new documentary called Fallout, which takes audiences behind the scenes of the making of the film On the Beach. The director of the documentary is Lawrence Johnson, who's with me now. Hi, Lawrence.
Hello. Hi. Thank
you
for having me.
Nice to have you here. And also with me is the writer Gideon Haig, who's one of the experts. I guess you're an expert on this. You certainly come across as an expert.
There aren't many experts. It's a pretty small field. But, yeah, I wrote a piece back in 2007 on the 50th anniversary of the release of the novel On the Beach, and got to understand a little bit about the author and the circumstances of its writing.
So you wrote that for the Monthly. What drew you to dig so deeply into the book?
It's funny. I read a book in 2006 called Voices Prophesying War by an English author called I.F. Clarke, and it's a history of sort of post-apocalyptic fiction. And it grants pride of place to On the Beach. It says it's one of the most ambitious and one of the most enduring of all those novels. And also, you know, one of the first and one of the most extreme, because it posits a world in which everyone is annihilated. Normally, writers of this kind of fiction give some sort of get-out clause. You know, there are super fallout shelters, or aliens invade, or they discover a miraculous cure.
Yes, there are
essentially... And some generations survive to repopulate the Earth. Well, Neville Shute says, there's a character in On the Beach who says, it's not the end of the world, but it's the end of us. Mm. And I dare say the world will get on fine without us.
Yeah. Yeah, the other books are sort of Noah's Ark stories, really, aren't they? But, yeah, everybody goes down this one. Let's talk very briefly about Neville Shute, because he's quite a character.
Oh, he's an extraordinary man. Yeah. I didn't know very much about his provenance when I came to write about him. He was a Briton. He was an engineer, fundamentally. He always looked upon himself as an engineer. He worked on the R-100 airship project. He founded an aerospace company called Airspeed. And in the evenings, he just started writing popular adventure fiction, a lot of it with aviation settings. And he started to grow more and more ambitious, and he began to entertain the idea of a popular author having sort of educating the public in important sort of moral or political or military issues. In 1939, he wrote a very interesting book called What Happened to the Corbetts, which is actually about the threat of strategic bombing to Britain. And it follows an ordinary family trying to survive what looks very much like a blitz from above, and this became a kind of a recurrent trope in Shute's fiction.
He was still living in England.
He was. The ordinary person in extraordinary circumstances. And in a sense, On the Beach, I think, is a bit of an updating of that idea. The ordinary person in the most extraordinary circumstances of all, trying to come to terms with not just a military threat from a visible enemy, but one from an invisible enemy that's completely irrefutable and irresistible.
Mm. So he moved from England to Australia. He bought a farm outside Melbourne and continued writing these books.
He sort of fell out of sympathy with Britain in the late 1940s as the Attlee government came to power. He was politically, he was probably a libertarian. He was sort of, he believed in the idea of sort of anti-democratic too. He believed that, you know, an elite, an intellectual elite should run every society. a lot of them should be engineers because he had a fundamental belief in the efficacy of engineering. But he came to Australia because he flew out here in the late 1940s and liked the country very much. He thought it would be sort of the best of Britain in the southern seas, and brought his family out here in 1950.
Now, Lawrence, you've directed this documentary, Fallout, which is all about the making of the film. As I say, it's about when Hollywood came to Melbourne.
Well, yeah, it is also, I mean, I have to say I'm quite excited for us because we've been able to tell this story. I mean, it's part of Australia's literary and cinematic history that not many people know about. And also, you know, there's never been a film about Neville Shute or Stanley Kramer. So there are also the biographical aspects of particularly Neville Shute. And as Gideon said, you know, he was involved with the Miscellaneous Weapons Department. And by the time in the mid-20th century, he was one of the highest paid novelists there was, as he also reminded people. He wrote A Town Like Alice as well, which he sort of saw as a bit of a potboiler, but it made money for him. But because he was so, he felt so strongly about what had happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, combined with other things to do with radiation that are being discovered as a adjunct, you know, as a following that, he wrote On the Beach as this obviously warning to the world.
So the producer and director is this American Stanley Kramer. How did he come across the book? Do we know?
Well, the book was a bestseller, so it was really, you know, overtook Pate and Place, I believe.
It sold 100,000 copies in its first 6 weeks in the US. It went straight to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. It was serialized in several score of newspapers. Eventually, it sold 4 million copies. So my argument is that it's probably the most significant Australian novel of all, in the sense that it tackles the sort of defining sort of moral and political issue of the age and puts it in an Australian setting, an extraordinarily subversive idea. It sort of takes this, it subverts this idea that we've always had that we're a long way away from the rest of the world and, you know, we're sort of beholden to the rest of it.
Yes, it does.
Because Australia is the most important country in the world momentarily at the moment of its greatest powerlessness.
Yes, it is unusual to have a story where it's not London or New York or Tokyo that stands for the world. It's Melbourne. In fact, it's people on the beach at Frankston, which is a you know, seaside suburb, just a train ride out of Melbourne. So this has bearing on what happens later on in our discussion. Stanley Kramer buys the rights to the book to make a film, and basically they give him total control of how that film will turn out. Now, he decides to shoot the film in Melbourne. I suppose he didn't need to do that. He could have relocated it the way Americans love to do, but he does decide to go with the story and set it in Melbourne. Do we know whether he angsted over this or whether that was laid down as there?
Stanley Kramer was involved with a number of films, and he had been deemed a message director, so his films all had social messages, and he used the film medium in terms of hopefully advancing the way people might think. I mean, that's the way he kind of thought as a showman and as a producer and director. You know, one of his later films was Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which, you know, involved race relations. And, you know, his films had had certain influences. You know, they might not have been major, but they provoked discussion within American society. And On the Beach was one of those. And Guess Who's Coming to Dinner probably was even more important as well, particularly because you know, it used popular actors like Catherine Hepburn, Sidney Poitier, Spencer Tracy, and in On the Beach, of course, he used Ava Gardner and Gregory Peck because he needed those people to basically sort of, you know, pepper the subject matter.
And so they come to Melbourne, and we have to say that Melbourne was a pretty sleepy place back then. I mean, the movie makes it look more sleepy because there's lots of shots of deserted streets as the movie goes on, but nevertheless, it was a kind of sleepy place. And we need to clear up one thing, because people will tell you that Ava Gardner said that Melbourne sure was the ideal place to make a film about the end of the world. It's a great line, but she never said it.
Well, they're going to have to go and see Fallout in the theatre, and they will find out all about that, because we explore it. But if I explain it on air, it's very boring, the background to that story. But well, we've covered it in the film.
All right, I don't know whether I'm going to let you keep your secret. I mean, it's been a well-known fact. I mean, it's constantly being attributed to her, even though for 20 years...
It's attributed to her,
We've known that she didn't say it. She didn't say it. In fact,
she said something very close.
It's like elementary, my dear Watson. He never actually said it.
No, it was a Melbourne journalist, Neil Gillett, who said it. He wrote it in The Age in 1959, and then he had a sort of joke about it, you know, that perhaps she would have said it.
Just on those final scenes, Michael, it's interesting. Shute first came out to Australia in 1949. He flew his private plane out here, Percival Proctor, with another young English author called James Riddell, and he stayed at the Melbourne Club. And in his diary, which is in the National Library, he talks about the first day, the first full day he was in Melbourne was a Sunday. And he walked out the door of the Melbourne Club, and of course the streets were deserted. They were completely desolate. You know, there were, you know, tumbleweeds virtually blowing down Bourke Street. And I kind of think that maybe this had some sort of impact, some sort of visual impact on him, the idea of the empty city, which of course we see in the final scenes of the film, that unforgettable banner over the front of the State Library, "There's still time, brother."
Mm. Yes, well, it is a powerfully sleepy image. This is Booksnards Daily on RN, and I'm talking to writer Gideon Haigh and director Lawrence Johnson because we're celebrating, or remembering, yes, celebrating, the book On the Beach, the novel On the Beach, a book about the end of the world, and it's the subject of a new documentary which Lawrence has directed called Fallout. So it is a very melancholy film. It's certainly not a Hollywood-style film in the sense of having a Hollywood ending. So you've got Gregory Peck as a genial and charming submarine captain.
Mm.
He's not the captain of a genial and charming submarine. He's a genial and charming man who captains a submarine. And he's always on the verge of tears because he knows that his lovely sons and his wife have been killed, but he won't admit it. He keeps talking about them as though they're still alive. There's a new actress to cinema called Donna Anderson who plays Mary, a young wife who's just had a baby, and she knows she's going to have to kill this baby because everyone's going to take suicide pills at the end because the radiation sickness is going to get them. Why did Kramer want to make the film? I mean, you said it was a message film. Let's go deeper into what it was that's really galvanising him.
Well, he was attracted to the novel for those reasons, and I think one of the things about the novel that is great about it is it's actually very simply written, but it actually explores incredibly provocative issues. The most present one is what you just mentioned in terms of the young couple who just had a baby. And then in 1957 or now, the idea that governments can make decisions about war that affect civilians to the point where they have to kill their own child and then take suicide pills for them to have some kind of ending to their life is a pretty horrible concept. And it's very strong. And I think, you know, those elements drew Kramer to it. There's also the emotional resonance of the relationships in the novel between particularly Ava Gardner and Gregory Peck's characters, which I'll call them rather than the novel characters because they're easier to explain. But, you know, Kramer was involved with obviously creating and uplifting the romantic aspects to that. And it's incredibly moving when, you know, Gregory Peck's character comes back from the Northern Hemisphere, and there's a great sequence in the film in the submarine where all the men discover that actually the world is annihilated and they have to come back under the water back to Melbourne. And essentially, you know, romantically, Gregory Peck has to come back to Ava Gardner, and in the film, he obviously gives himself to her and she to him at the end of the world. I mean, that romantic premise is very strong, I think. And you know, it's incredibly poignant, and the way that Kramer came here and brought the production and really had a lot of integrity, I think, about Shute's novel, even though there were differences and Shute didn't like the film, Kramer's done a wonderful job.
Yeah. It's quite disturbing. It's so prescient too, isn't it? Because the book and the film both are created in the 50s. It's set, you know, just a few years in the future, 1964. In fact, the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred in 1962.
Yes.
So the world came very close to exactly the scenario that this film imagined.
And I think that the real coup of Shute's novel and as a result the film is that it happens it's set after everything's happened. It's the epilogue to the end of the world, and everyone is absolutely powerless to prevent what's the fate that's going to befall them. And they're in a sense just ticking off the days until their inevitable final demise. And as Osborne, the scientist in the film, says, he's sort of the Shute equivalent, his science character who provides probably the most rational perspective on things. He said, well, you always knew that you were going to die. Now you just know when.
Mm. Do you have a personal stake in this message? Do you share this concern?
Well, I'm a filmmaker, I guess, and a storyteller. I'm not a nuclear activist. But, you know, one of the reasons the film was made at the moment was because the world that Shute explored, which were the dubious and, I guess, nefarious nature of nuclear energy and weaponry and how that is used or misused, underlies it. And basically because of what's happened recently, you know, with things like Fukushima, we have a world where governments, again, control things like going to war. They control certain resources, and we don't necessarily have the knowledge of those resources completely, and nobody knows what accidents can prevail and, you know, and happen. And in the future, there are places, you know, which have nuclear waste or, you know, used for energy that possibly through, you know, nature which is out of our control, could be, you know, impaired and have accidents and pollute the earth. So I guess the message for the film, Fallout film, underlying is that we, it's like, you know, we have a lot of dialogue about climate change, but there are other things in the world to think about too that may affect the, you know, future generations, and maybe not future generations so far away, you know.
It's not, it's interestingly, it's not a Cold War artifact. The film specific, the book specifically proposes a nuclear conflagration breaking out, not through ideological differences, but through an accidental escalation of a small-scale conflict in the Middle East. It's so it's not actually a disarmament film or not actually a pacifist book. It's a non-proliferation scenario, and if anything, that's the world in which into which we've been born.
You're on Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart, and I'm talking to Gideon Haig and to Loris Johnson about On the Beach, the movie, and the book On the Beach, and also about the documentary they've both been involved in. It's just recalling, you know, how it all worked. I watched it again last night, actually, and the movie, I mean, and it's very odd to see Ava Gardner, Anthony Hopkins, and Donna Anderson, this young American, playing Australians. In fact, I'd forgotten that, not Anthony Hopkins, Anthony
Perkins.
I'd forgotten that Anthony Perkins was the Australian, that he was an Australian. When I saw, oh, he's wearing an Australian Navy uniform. He's in the Australian Army, Australian Navy. Did it rankle at the time with audiences to see these Hollywood stars playing Aussies?
Well, you know, I have to say the accents aren't great in terms of the...
Well, they hardly tried.
That's right. I think the thing is, you know, people just accepted it because it was Hollywood and that was the Hollywood machine. Yeah. I think particularly for Melbourne audiences, from what I've heard, that because of the circus of the filming here, when they went to see it at the premiere at the Regent, were quite shocked because even though they knew what On the Beach was about in terms of its subject, the way that Kramer photographed it, directed it, and the mood of the film is, you know, it's very kind of realistic and dour. And to see their own city portrayed in that way, I think was probably quite disturbing.
Yes, it premiered in the Regent Theatre in Melbourne, which is now hosting King Kong. It's quite a another kind of American story. I mean, I think it's an extraordinary film. I just wonder how people took it all at the time with all these Hollywood stars, you know, going around the town. My dad always used to tell me a story that when we used to sit on the beach at Queenscliff when I was a little boy, we'd look over at Point Nepean, and he would say off that point there, there used to be a wreck called the Time, and the Time was a steamship that sank in 1949. Yes. And apparently you could see the waves breaking on it. And he always told me that when they made the film, they blew it up to clean up the shot. He was always rather cross about that. I've never heard anyone else tell that story, but my dad always claimed that.
Incredible amount of stories and anecdotes about the filming of On the Beach here. Supposedly there's a piano at the end of the pier at Phillip Island where after a big party with Ava Gardner and everybody, they just got the piano and took it out and rolled it down to the end. You know, supposedly Bill Hunter lost his virginity to Ava Gardner. You know, supposedly...
Are we allowed to say that? My Lord! Well, oh, it's got racy.
We've said it before, but you know, I mean, Ava was a... pretty amazing woman. I mean, she was incredibly beautiful and she lived her life like a man and, you know, was a hard worker as well.
Now, so, I don't want to finish without covering the point I said we'd cover at the start, which is about Neville Shute's response to the film. So as we wind up, he'd sold the film rights. He had no control over the film and it really upset him.
Yes. Well, it was pretty close to him. I think for the reasons we said earlier is that the subject matter coming out of, you know, the previous novel, the Corbett's novel, you know, and him interested in the goodness of people and under states of complete adversity, I think particularly that issue for him being muddied or tampered with in the way that Kramer did, he, you know, Neville should have a very strong moral compass and, you know, Kramer took it into a realm that he just didn't agree with.
Just too much sex.
Yeah, but I think he also had problems with the American actors. I think the problem with euthanasia, even though I think that those scenes in the film are, that's all handled very well, and it's very moving.
Interestingly, the house in which Shute wrote the book is still intact. It's owned by someone else now. It's run as a B&B. It's down in Lang Warren, and I went and stayed down there when I was researching my piece. You can actually sit in the room at where On the Beach was composed, and you can also sit in the same position as Shute was when he died, because he actually died on page 30 of his final incomplete novel, Incident at Eucla, and the manuscript for that is in the National Library. He got to the full stop and reached his own personal full stop.
Oh, dear. So he had a heart attack, and the... Well, the story has always been that he was so upset about the movie. He'd worked himself in such a state. He already had a bad heart and that it finished him off.
Well, it did. He, to be realistic about it, he had a series of heart attacks and ill health throughout his life. But again, he did stress himself out so much about it. And as his daughter has said, he was quite apoplectic about the whole thing.
Well, look, I enjoyed the documentary immensely. And it gave me such a wonderful opportunity, such a wonderful excuse to go back and watch the movie too. So it was a double pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just say that it opens this week at Dendy Newtown on the 5th on Thursday for a season, and hopefully people will come along and see it on the big screen, because documentaries rarely get released in theatres here unless they're particularly American films. And this is a great part of history, and it's quite entertaining as well.
And in cinemas elsewhere in Australia?
It's in Canberra as well, and we've just had a Melbourne season, and there'll be some screenings at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image as well as the George Cinema in St Kilda.
Lawrence Johnson is the director of the new documentary Fallout, and Gideon Haig is a writer who's featured in the film. And Gideon's article is really worth looking at. It's called Shoot the Messenger, as in Neville Shoot. Nice joke. That was published in the Monthly, and it's pretty easy to track out online.